How'd you know what my favorite color was? Just mention it back to him a few months later. Of course, in a friendly, casual way. How do you like my new shades? They're your favorite color. How'd you know that? Well, you told me that a couple months ago. I did? Yeah, you did. What goes through the kid's mind? What's your subtitle? I listened to you and I was thinking about you. And what you tell me doesn't go in one ear and out the other. And I don't forget about you. And I don't only retain those things that are important to my practice. The best thing for a kid is a surprise. To know that you were thinking about him. Or thinking about her. Something that they once told you. There's this girl who I know. I was her teacher in school. She was thrown out of school, sort of. She's living on the streets now, 15 years old. She has no home. Her parents, in the 4 months that she was gone, didn't make one phone call to inquire anywhere if the girl's alive or dead. It was her birthday a couple weeks ago. Her friends made her a party in Bissola restaurant on Coney Island Avenue. I called one of her friends and I said, what could I get this girl for a birthday present? And she said, you know, the girl is walking down Avenue J. Well, first she said, I don't know, let's call another one of her friends, and we conferenced it. Now the girl was walking down Avenue J and she looked in a window and she saw this dress and she liked it. End of story. I said, how much did that dress cost? She said, $20. So $20! Buy it for her and gift wrap it. It's not the present. When she opens that package, how did the rabbi know? The answer is, he asked one of my friends, who asked another one of my friends, who remembered that I liked this dress, and he got it for me. Believe me, it's not the dress that's going to make her feel good. It's the fact that people conspired to make her feel happy. And instead of going to the store and buying her something just like this, I was thinking about her. And I spent time, even something so silly like this. I was thinking about her, and I wanted to find out what will make her happy. Know him and love him. There's no love without accurate knowledge. Very important. And this is where it comes in. Kid says to the father, you don't love me. And the father says, yes, I do. And the father really loves the kid. But the kid really feels the father doesn't love him. What's happening over here? Doesn't it say, Dvarim ha-yoytzim min ha-lev nechnosim el ha-lev? I'll tell you what's happening here. From my perspective. What's happening here is what Reb Nachman Breslov said about the Misnagdim, but the opposite. Nachman Breslov, we know, is a big Hasidish Rebbe, and he was one of the primary targets of the Misnagdim in his days. He once said about those Misnagdim that targeted him, quote, them, they have nothing against me. They have something against that person who they think I am. He deserves it. End quote. Which Reb Nachman is saying is that you can't be on the receiving end of somebody's hate, and I don't mean that in a negative way, or somebody's disagreement, unless they know you. Otherwise, their hate is directed towards that imaginary fellow that you are not. And the same thing applies to love. If a kid feels that his father or mother do not understand him, he feels like a stranger in his own home. He feels like somebody switched babies and cradles when he was born in the hospital, and he doesn't belong in this house. He will never feel loved by those parents, because what goes through his head is, they don't love me. They love that person who they think I am. Lucky kid. You can't love somebody unless you have a certain degree of understanding and knowledge of who he is. Oh, you could love him, but they'll never feel it. They'll know you love somebody, but it won't be them. I'm a stranger. You love me. You love the person you think I am. If you would know what I'm doing, who I am, what I want, What does it have to do with your love? It's what we call in Hebrew mekach tois. It's a mistake. The love is a mistake. That's how the kid feels. So when the kid says, he doesn't love me, and the father, with tears in his eyes, says, yes, I do, usually what's happening is that the kid feels misunderstood, and that's the subtitle under, he doesn't love me. Which means, I feel like I'm a stranger in my own home. He doesn't understand me. So how could he love me? He loves that other imaginary kid that he thinks he has. The mirage, the illusion, the ghost. You want a kid to feel that you care about him? Get to know him. Not just on a professional level. Tell me about the relationship between you and your children. How many of you know your children's favorite colors? How many of you know who your children's best friend is in school? Best friend. Worst enemy? Favorite experience this year in school? Least favorite? Most painful? This is the stuff that bonds between parents and children are made of. You want to get close to your daughters, wash the dishes with them. And just talk about shtusim the whole time. And get to know them as a friend. Because the more you know them, the more they're going to feel that love that you have for them. My wife asks me sometimes, I tell her, last night I was by a vort in Flatbush, and then afterwards, I live in Far Rockaway. I said, as long as I'm going to be in Brooklyn, I said, I have to meet this kid. Here in Borough Park. So my wife got a ride home and I went to Borough Park. Came back, middle of the night, middle of the morning. She says, what did you do with him? I said, nothing. I said, for hours? Nothing? I said, yeah, nothing. We went, we had some ice cream, whatever. But I'm getting to know him. He's getting to know me. So, of course, I have nothing to write in my notes. Spent 3 hours. Mocha fudge sundae. Cherry on top. Doesn't sound like anything. But this kid knows, is going to know, that I care about him. And the truth is that I do. You see, I don't want anybody here to think that this is any tricks or anything. I was on the radio, and Curtis Sliwa, who's a good friend of ours, invited me to his radio show to speak about parents and kids. And somebody came over to me, one of the people who I work with, and said, Rabbi, says, if you talk about it, the kids will know all your tricks. I said, I have no tricks. I said, yes, the kids are going to hear that if you want to influence them, be their friend. And the kids are going to hear that I care about them. And the kids are going to hear that my relationship with them is not only that they need something and I'm a do-gooder and I'm out to help them and then I close the file. The kids are going to hear that. Never, they're going to know all my tricks. You see what kind of society we live in? These are tricks. It's true that Tvarim Hayotzim and Halev Nechnosim and Halev. And your subtitles are going to come through. The easy but wrong way to try to get the right subtitles through is to try to put on an act. To make sure, what did I say? What does he think? The right way and the harder way is to really mean it. If you know him and you always think about him and he knows you think about him and not about his case and his problems. You think about him. If you notice the kid comes in with a broken belt buckle, you don't say a word. A week later, he walks into your desk, there's a new belt buckle. It cost you $4. But what does it tell the kid? I noticed. I was thinking about it. I spent 2 minutes during the week to go buy this silly little thing. You'll get him immediately. These are all ways to be friends with a kid. And once you're a friend, you are in a position to have the most influence over him, more than his parents, his teachers, and his regular therapists. Rule number two, it's a little shorter than rule number one, always be cool, confident, and casual. And this comes in specifically with acting out teenagers. And it's not enough to expect proper behavior. You must be sincerely puzzled when it is not forthcoming. Without this, your subtitle says you expect misbehavior. Meaning like this. Everybody knows that if you expect a kid to act a certain way, he will act a certain way. Right? That's an old rule. I once went to a yeshiva. I don't want to say the name, an out-of-town yeshiva. First day I walk into the yeshiva, there's the candy machine, there's masking tape all over the front, and there's a sign on the machine. Whoever broke the glass and took the candies should please return it or pay for it because of Bichel Hashem. Then afterwards, I left that yeshiva, I went to Lakewood. In Lakewood, they don't have a candy machine. Do you know how they sell the candies? They have in the dining room, there's a locker with a combination lock. The combination to the lock is posted in the locker on the locker in Hebrew so that only the religious Jews will understand it. You open up the locker and there's a little cup where you put the money and you take the candies that are just sitting there. Now, I am certain that this man who's in this business makes more money Elul than the rest of the year. However, he's in business. And if you treat somebody like a mensch, they're going to act like a mensch. Everybody knows. This is the Mesilas Yesharim's rule. That the chitzonius is mashpia on the panemius. If you want to get a crook to stop breaking into houses, give him a policeman's uniform. Let him enforce the laws. And then he will start keeping them. That's an old rule. But it's not enough. That's not what this says. This says like this. Let's say you have a teenager and you heard that the kid's a psychopath. Okay? You heard that he's involved in self-destructive activities and the whole nine yards. He comes to your office and he picks up the lamp on your table and he smashes it on the floor and he looks to you with a smile on your face for your reaction. There are a lot of things that you could do. And I'm not telling you what to do because it's your lamp and your money. But what I would do, you look at him and you say, what just happened? What? In other words, you imagine as if it wasn't this psychopath that did it. It was your friend sitting next to you. Look at the person sitting next to you. How would you react if they came into your office one day, picked up the lamp and smashed it on a table? You'd be puzzled. You'd be confused. And however you and your own particular personality express that confusion and puzzlement, that's what you would say, right? In your own way. That's the way I would react to this kid. Because that tells him, subtitle, that in my eyes, you are a person. I expect from you normal behavior. Not, okay, you're in my office now. You're really a psychopath. I know you're crazy. And I know you're going to do something nuts. But you're in my office. You respect my territory. And I expect you to act like a mensch over here. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about sincere expectation. If you sincerely expect him to act normal, then when he goes off and away from that normal, you will act just as puzzled and in the exact same way as if your best friend had just committed the same act. And even though you're telling him, yes, I expect you to act like I mentioned this office, your subtitle says, look, you're a psychopath. I'm not interested in you doing anything to me or in my office. Therefore, I expect you to act differently. He's testing you. And it works so often and so well. The way you perceive them, that's the way they're going to act. Trust. All these kids want to be trusted. Trust, and that's rule number four. We're going to skip a little down there. The amount of trust you have in someone is directly proportionate to the amount of risk you're willing to take because of them. The definition of trust, it's the definition, is the amount of risk that I'm willing to take because of you. If you're my babysitter, I trust you. What does that mean? That means I'm willing to risk you babysitting my children. If I lend you my car and I say I trust you with my car, that trust is only there because there's an amount of risk. If I let you babysit for me, but I have video cameras all over, And I have all my neighbors on call to make sure, watching in the closed circuit TVs, to make sure nothing happens, then I don't trust you. Why? Because I'm not willing to take a risk. Trust, the definition of trust, I know what it says in Webster, but the definition of trust is the amount of risk that I'm willing to take because of you. And if you want to convince a kid that you trust him, and if you trust him, they will be trustworthy. Now listen. There's a price to pay for this attitude. Because they're going to stab you in the back a few times. And it's not always going to work. But in the long run, it's worth it. It's going to hurt. The price to pay for trust is hurt. But if you trust them, they're going to be trustworthy, slowly but surely. But you know why often it doesn't work? People say, yeah, I tried, it didn't work. Because you didn't really trust them. Way back in the back of your mind, you thought, I don't trust you. But it says in the books that I have to trust you. So let me see how it works. Your subtitles are showing through. It's not going to work. I once got a kid, and the truth is, here I was lucky, because there was really very little risk. I had lunch with him in a restaurant. On my way out, I stopped to use the men's room. I gave him the keys to my car. I said, it's the white Ford Escort in the front. Wait for me there. And he looks at me. I turned around and I walked away. But he looks at me with the keys for just a second. He's like, wow, you just met me for the first time. And you're treating me like a normal human being. Now, he got to be crazy to run off with my car. There really is very little risk there. Because I know who he is, in 2 seconds I'll be out there. He got to be nuts. But in his mind, I just gave a stranger the keys to my car. And the keys to the car are symbolic to these kids, just like cars are symbolic, especially boys. Girls is different. And I got him like that. You trust me. You got to trust them. That's the rule. Bet the rent. I have lost a lot of money on these kids and a lot of time on these kids. And I've sustained a lot of pain because of them. But that's the minority. The vast majority, if you trust somebody, he's going to be more trustworthy. Listen, I'm sure we tell it to parents all the time, where the kid says, my parents don't trust me. And the parents say, well, the kid doesn't deserve the trust. Who takes the first step? Well, if you show her that you trust her, maybe she'll be trustworthy. It's not good enough to show her that you trust her. You have to really trust her. And trust means to take risks on her. And then that'll work. Cool, confident, and casual means, if you want to know how to respond to this kid, the formula is as follows. And it's a formula across the board. A, step A, figure out how you would like this kid to be. B, imagine he is just like that. And C, react accordingly as if that type of person would have done this. Let's say somebody borrowed money from you for food and he used it on drugs or something. And it happens. One time a kid asked me, Rabbi, on 13th Avenue, 49th Street, he asked me, Rabbi, could you drive me to this, what was that, on 65th Street and 14th, there's that grocery there? Could you drive me to that grocery? And I said, fine. It's like a 24-hour thing. No, it wasn't Pathmark. It was 14th. Whatever, little thing. I drive him there. I'm there, he says, Rabbi, could you lend me $3? Give him $3. He comes out with a cheeseburger. Like some trafer thing. You have no idea how much that hurt. I mean, I didn't even want to drive him. I was busy. I drove him. Once we get there, could you lend me $3? If you would have asked me before, I would have said no. Could you lend me we're here already. Well, I'm going to say no and drive you back. $3. And he goes in and comes out with this. Ooh. I have never in my life ever felt so used just like that. The next time he asked me for it, I said no. He says, why? I said, because you're going to go in there and get a cheeseburger like you did last time. And you know what? That's the same way that I would have reacted if an equal of me, of mine, would have done that. I didn't say anything on the spot. And I'm not saying, yes, say something on the spot or not say something. The formula is, how do you want this kid to be? Then imagine he is like that. And then figure out, how would you react if that were the case? If a psychopath comes in and breaks something in your office, how would you, unless it's for your own protection, that's a different story. How would you react if a normal person, a friend of yours, would have come in and done just that? If these kids see that you and your friends and their friends start treating them a certain way, I promise you, they will soon be that way. Sometimes all these kids need is somebody to believe in them. I'll tell you a story of the Satmar Rebbe Zatzal, who did this to a kid. And he fulfilled rule 2, 3, 4, and 1 in one fell swoop. The Satmar Rebbe Zatzal had a policy that he would never, ever write a haskama for anybody. Haskama is an approbation inside a book. When you write a sefer, you go to a rav, he writes, I saw the sefer, even though he may never have seen it, and it's a good sefer, and you sell it. Fine. Satmar Rebbe never did that. That was his policy. There was an 18-year-old kid who ran away from home. And for some reason, he came to Satmar Rebbe. He figured, this Satmar family, he came to the Satmar Rebbe and he said, I'm running away from home. So Satmar Rebbe said, fine, you run away from home, but you're coming to me. Coming to me, you're going to live with me. Satmar Rebbe didn't have children. For a long time, this was, for all practical purposes, the child of the Satmar Rebbe. You're going to live with me. Anything you want, he told him. Gashmius and Ruchnius, that was his words. Just let me know when it's yours. Now listen to this. One day, now the kid had nothing to do. The whole day. And he was good in yeshiva. And he was learning and he was writing notes, whatever. Like a good boy. Just didn't get along with his parents. One day, Satmar Rebbetzin, who knew this boy, she was fond of him, told the Rebbe, you know, he writes notes the whole day. He's writing Chidushei Torah. He can soon write a Sefer. 18-year-old kid. Satmar Rebbe looks up at him and says, is this true? So what's the kid supposed to say? He shrugged and smiled. And Satmar Rebbe tells him, you write a Sefer and I give you a Haskama. On the spot. That was a turning point in that kid's life. 3 weeks he had a Sefer. In 3 weeks. He didn't sleep, he didn't eat. And he had that sefer. And the Satmar Rebbe gave him his haskama. And in yeshiva, after they threw him out of yeshiva, they threw him out of yeshiva also when he ran away from home. They threw him out of yeshiva, he came back with the last laugh, I wrote a sefer. And I have the Satmar Rebbe's haskama. And that was the turning point, because Satmar Rebbe put his neck on the line for that kid. That's what it means, bet the rent. He looks at the Satmar Rebbe. Satmar Rebbe was king of the world. This is king of the world. And the kid said, I'm a punk little kid who runs away from home and gets thrown out of yeshiva. Yeah, I'm good in learning. But parents don't want me. My rebbeim don't want me. The biggest rish yeshivas and rabbonim in the world came to him for haskam and he said, no, it's my policy. I don't give. And to me, why? Because Satmar Rebbe said, well, if I give a haskama, there's something in it. I may not like it. That was his style. For me, he's writing a haskama. What does that say about me? And if I write a stupid sefer, who's the fool? The Satmar Rebbe. And he's willing to take that risk because he promised it to me already. He believes in me. And now I know the guy. This was the turning point in this person's life. Turning point. That's bet the rent. Cool, confident, and casual, riding a sefer, no problem, I'll give you a haskama, and be a friend. And rule number 3, he also did. Hit him with a truck. No, we have a problem. Problem is that our kids don't think. They don't think anymore. They grow up with Sesame Street, which is very easy, junk food type learning. Television, video games, they don't even read anymore. Everybody knows this, that kids don't read. And if you're a teacher, if you're in school, you know that you can get the kids to say how they feel about this. their variants of feelings. Well, I feel this way and my opinion is this, but to get them to think and to analyze an idea objectively with a ruthless thought process is very difficult. Because that's our society. Everything is quick, without any thinking, without any effort. We want them to learn, so we make it the easiest way for them. We have records, don't talk Lashon Hara. To sit down and read a sefer about Lashon Hara is very, very difficult. They know all about it. And somebody, an 8th grade Rebbe, told me that he's giving us shir in the Shav Shmaitz. It's a sefer he gave to the 8th graders. And he sees them sitting there waiting for the shin to jump out and start dancing. It's very hard for them to think. They are being bombarded by sensory messages, but not intelligent ones. The commercials on TV that people pay millions of dollars for 30-second slots. So obviously it's effective if people are willing to pay that much. Don't give messages. Flash a picture here, flash a picture there, the right color, the right angle, the right place, and the kid buys something. That's what they're used to. And we, as educators, and as a Torah community, are competing with all this sensory input that these kids are getting. Because what we have to do is simple reading, logic, thinking. Without thinking, education is gone. And it's not even a problem with them. Moshe Rabbeinu was susceptible to this. It says in the Sefer HaIkrim, it's written by a Rishon, that the reason why Moshe Rabbeinu, after God told him the Jews are worshipping the eagle, he didn't break the luchas. He went down, he saw it, then he broke them. You know why? Because even though it was Hashem himself who told Moshe Rabbeinu himself that the Jews were doing this, and he believed it, of course, without a pebble of a doubt, without a shadow of a doubt, it makes a different effect when you see it. Seeing it makes a greater effect than Hashem telling you, even on Moshe Rabbeinu's level. Then he couldn't take it, he broke the luchas. It's a sensory perception. And that's what we're fighting with these kids. And it's a very big problem. Because what messages they're giving them out there on the TV and the messages we're giving them are, they collide, they're contradictory. And what do you think has a greater impact? It's the messages out there. And that's one of the reasons we have a big problem. Solution, rule number 3, hit them with a truck. Overwhelming a teenager's sensory intake devices is necessary to make an impression. What does this mean? That means that you have to overwhelm him with your concern. Mother came to me, Satma lady, she had a kid, a yoili, 14 years old, which is just about as old as you have to be in order to be a yoili. He had low self-esteem. In camp, he started getting involved with the bad crowd. He really wants to be good, but, you know, he doesn't really think highly of himself. Mother's a social worker, happens to be. Satmila, she's a social worker. Yeah. She lives here in Borough Park. When I was in... Yeah. She's a social worker. Became a social worker later on in life. And she was doing all the right things. She wasn't making mistakes, but it just... I told the mother that he needs a good relationship with a good Rebbe. But it just, he doesn't want to take the first step. So the Rebbe, who's a very, very nice man, he's not in Satna, he's one of these Chassidish yeshivas over here, a different one. He tried to be makar of the kid, he invited him for Shabbos and this and that. It didn't work. So I gave her the following advice. I said, make him lava malka in his honor. I said, have it catered in your house. Have a big house. Have it catered in your house. He doesn't know anything about this. Surprise. One Matzah Shabbos, we have the caterer with the brothers and the sisters, and everybody has to be planning this for a month. Because if you plan it for less than a month, it's no good. He has to know you're planning it for a month. And you have big signs up. It's Yoili Day. And you invite his Rebbe to be the guest speaker. And the Rebbe should conspire as well. And everybody should do it just to give this kid attention. But not stam attention. Blow his mind with the attention. One shot. Blow his mind with the attention. You'll shake him up. To get a kid to shake him now, you can't just give him attention. You can't just slap him in the face to wake him up. You got to hit him with a truck. There was this girl who I was dealing with. Very nice girl. C-minus student from a C-minus family in a C-minus neighborhood. You know, and she was starting to become a C-minus person in terms of frumkeit and personality. Goes to one of the regular Beis Yaakov high schools in Brooklyn. And once a year, well, I think once every 4 years, the girls in that place get to teach a Chumash, a Parsha, for one day. And they get marked on it, and it has the status like of a final. And this girl, every year, C minus, this, that, whatever, it's not her fault, that's her family, that's her existence. I told her, we're going to help you with your report. The report includes a written report about the Parsha, an oral lesson, and these posters, visual aids, whatever. Got a professional artist. A professional artist. And the girls get marked on this, it's like a contest, and it's a big competition. Now this is a C-minus type girl, right? Like, very mediocre. Got a professional artist to do the posters. Not just like, you know, professional artist, but really good. Like an oh wow type thing. We got her a rabbi to do the report for her, not on her level, but the best he could do. The best he could do. And to have a typeset in Rashi print on a computer with a professional cover. With a cover. And the speech was also by rabbi. She had the top help. But not the top help to help of, she was 17, a 17-year-old girl in school. The top of the top. It's, I call it my Cinderella for one day thing. Cinderella for one day. She came to, she opened up that poster. She was crying. She handed in this report, and she knew everything. As of course the first time the teacher ever gave an aleph, because the teacher never. The girl is a different girl since then. Different girl. Of course, you need follow-up. It's not going to change a person's life in a second. But it's what you call like a jump start. You got to hit him with a truck. To invite somebody to your house for Shabbos is passé. It doesn't work anymore. Because you can't compare to MTV. The thrill and the sensory input that they get from the Sitra Achra, from the other side, is what we are competing with. We have to hit him with a truck. What was it? What's the old vort? What Eliezer saw in Rivka? Rivka brought water to the camels. Big deal. Big deal. Weren't there Jews that did a lot greater things? It's not my vort, it's old vort. There were 10 camels there. A camel doesn't drink a lot, but when they drink, watch out. One camel drinks enough for 30 men. 10 camels is equal to 300 men just come out of the desert. Okay? And this little girl, 6 years old, 7 year old girl, with a pail of water, a cup of water, what do you think it takes for her to give water from a well to 300 men? How many times did she run back and forth to that well? And how many times did people say, no, let me take this? And she, no. They thought she was crazy. And that's what it was. She went crazy for that chesed. She hit him with a truck. She became the mother of Klal Yisrael because she did something. If you would see this, you'd be looking a shidduch for your son, and you saw this girl do this, you'd turn your back and quickly walk the other way. You'd say, she's crazy. She was. Pasuk says, Mishuga ish haruach. She blew Eliezer's mind back and forth and back and forth 100 times, 200 times, 300 times. Can you imagine? Without any elaborate mafarshim, this is simple mathematics. Hundreds of times she went back and forth to that well. That's what they saw in her. This is what you have to do. It's like, this works everywhere, by the way. It works with your husband, with your wife. I tell the people in my shul all the time, when I talk to them about shalom bayis, I say, you buy your wife a present, she opens it up and says, wow, thank you very much, you failed. She opens it up and says, you know you're crazy? Then you've gotten her something good. The kids that we deal with know that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in the middle of the night, no matter what the sacrifice, within, of course, physical limitations. They've got us. 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, here, there, whatever it is, no matter what it is, they've got us. We try very, very hard to hit them with a truck, just overwhelm them with our care for them. And maybe, after all of that, we can make somewhat of an impact. It's getting late, and I don't have much more time. But this is, in short, the 4 rules that we use in our organization to deal with these kids. Yes? I'm going to. One more thing, though, before I take your questions. There's a very thin line between curative work and psychological therapy. If you have a kid that's rebellious, doesn't want to keep Shabbos, so the mother doesn't know whether to send it to a shrink or to a rabbi, or to a yeshiva, or to a friend, or to what. There's a word from the Shin of a Rav that goes like this. A lady came to the Shin of a Rav and told him, "My son went crazy. He dances with shiksas and he eats chazerim." So Shin of a Rav says, "Crazy? If he would dance with chazerim and eat shiksas, he'd be crazy. He's not crazy. He has the Yetzirah, he's weak, everybody has Bechira, this is what, that's he's weak, he's, you know, doing bad, he's not crazy." That's what Shin of a Rav said. Very, very often we misdiagnose, everybody in this world has Bechira, that's why we're here. God gave us the free will to choose right from wrong. Now sometimes the reduction in the kid's frumkeit level comes as a result of all sorts of emotional difficulties in the home, and Judaism, so to speak, gets caught in the crossfire. And once you take care of the difficulties, you're back. And this, I want to tell you, if there's any common denominator, or the most common denominator from all the kids that I deal with is those kids whose parents don't get along with each other. More than any... Not a surprise.
Is it true?
What do you mean? Oh, yes, yes. We have some whose parents are very fine and everything, but we do have some whose parents just don't get along with each other. 80% just don't get along with each other. Divorce, separated, throwing pots, whatever it is. And that's the worst. And it's a pasuk in Chumash, it's a Rashi. Rashi says, why is the... Gemara, Rashi brings it. Why is the parsha of Ben Soiru Moira next to Yifas Toyar? Because if you marry Yifas Toyar, what does it say? You come to hate her, and then you come to have as Ben Soiru Moira. In other words, you marry the Yifas Toyar, then you come to hate her. Because you hate her, you'll end up with a Ben Soiru Moira. It's clear. You hate your wife, you'll end up with a Ben Soiru Moira. That's what it says. And that's the way it is. But it's very important to be able to ascertain... If the wife hates the husband, I don't think the husband is going to like her too much too quick anyway, for too long. You have to be able to determine, is this a professional issue? Is this a regular Bechira issue? Is this a Frumkeit issue? Questions, please. Yes, ma'am.
One question I have is, how long does it take, if and when, well, I don't know how many numbers really come back.
Mm-hmm.
And how long a process is it?
Okay.
3 years?
I mean, oh, yes. The answer is yes. The answer is yes. As far as numbers coming back, we have a problem in our industry as you do in yours. What's considered coming back? If we have a kid who's Machal Shabbos and is not Machal Shabbos anymore, but he still has other problems, that coming back. Or there's another kid, that girl in the pamphlet, she was, for all practical purposes, a prostitute when we got a hold of her. Now she's a very nice, upstanding citizen in the community. She doesn't even have any boyfriend, but she is a Beshita monogamous. She has a job, she's getting her education, but Frumkeit isn't an issue by her. Is that a success? Depends who you ask. In terms of kids that improve their lives, almost everyone, the hardest part is getting the initial contact.
How long
a process? Okay, if you're talking about a kid that runs away from home, and my father beats me up, my mother beats me up, I'm no good in school, whatever. get the kid home, negotiate a settlement between the parents, and keep follow-up to make sure that things are safe, okay? That is the easiest, most satisfying type of thing. A kid like this motorcycle gang guy, 2 years, a year and a half it took. Sometimes it's, if there's a specific problem that needs help, kid is out of school, you need to get into a school, get her into a school. Done. And the school takes care of it. If there's a specific problem that needs a specific solution, that can be done quickly. If it's a general problem, you know, that needs a general solution, just the kid himself is, it's not the circumstances, the kid himself, it could take a couple of years. It could.
Are there certain ages that are more amenable to than others? Like at 16,
the older they are, well, sometimes the older they are, the more stuck in their ways they are. But more often than not, it was a surprise to me, the older they are, sometimes the easier it is to get them back. Why? Because they see that they gained nothing the past few years. Yeah?
Given the agency in terms of so-called professionalism, as you brought it up before, is there any cooperative process that we can have where we maintain our professional relationship with them?
Sure, I do it all the time. We have, as a matter of fact, one of the services that we offer, we have a computerized referral service for professional agencies and practitioners. I have on the computer, and I got it from my own work plus the referral lists from various Jewish organizations. About 150 Orthodox practitioners in the New York City area, including their strengths, their weaknesses, their dislikes, their orientation, their degrees and geographical location. And I can tell the computer I need somebody that specializes in 15-year-old redheads from Bulgaria, only a woman, and he has to be able to prescribe medicine. Boop, boop, boop. If there is such a person, he comes out. We do work with them. We do. It's a very good thing, because you get them from all angles that way. Nobody can hit them from all angles. Yes?
Let's say we get a call from a parent or from a concerned friend of a child. And this is that that one comes over.
The establishment.
What advice should we give this person in terms of how this child can
by me? Well, first, you may be able to access him, and the idea is this. Every kid, besides, they don't want to be helped, but they are looking for something. Maybe they're looking for a job, maybe they're looking for an apartment, maybe they're looking for a school. If this kid says, well, Ohel says they can help you with a school, or Ohel says they can help you maybe find an apartment, then it's no big deal, all you got to do is look in the back of the paper. The chances are maximized that they'll come because of that. But the way to get a hold of me is to just call.
Will you help us get a child
to
school?
Yeah, I would help you to get a child. There's certain schools, we have certain politicians that work with us. Assemblyman Dov Hykind is on our board of directors. And there are certain schools, one call from Dov, and the kid's in. Yeah. And there are certain schools, one call from Dov, and the kid's in. As a matter of fact, by our reception we had, he spoke. And I introduced him, and I said that it's very nice of him. He goes through a lot of effort. It's not just a political thing by him. He really cares about the kids. He got up and says, no, Rabbi Shapiro's wrong. It's a political thing. I called. They have to do it. They owe me a favor. I owe them a favor. And they owe me a favor, and that's it. And sometimes like that. So we have other people also that get kids into schools. Depends which school. But I'll gladly help if I can.
Which school takes?
Okay. It depends on which kids. There are... High school, yeah. There are different schools that take different level kids. You may want to try TAB, Torah Academy of Brooklyn. You may want to try Chanoch Lena. If you're looking at me with those eyes, I want you to know that there is no mainstream school where we would send...
Oh, TAB isn't taking these kids. They're not taking them.
Dove doesn't help with TAG. Dove doesn't help with TAG. Different, it's not important. It's where? What? I know what kind of kids they have in the school. I mean, I don't know exactly what type of kids we're talking about, but they're not geared to produce the Chafetz Chaim. Well, how do they get them? Fine, whatever. There are a lot of schools, but the problem is like this. All of these schools that are really, one, who pays, two, all of these schools that have these type of kids, I'm talking mamish delinquent type kids, it's not a school, it's a circus. It's a circus. There has been no school that was successful in making a group setting and putting them in a school and dealing with them like that. They feed off each other, they eat off each other. There are schools where you can get drugs in the dormitory. And unless the kid that you're placing there is the worst kid in the school, it may pull him down. It's a big danger. People tell me, are you going to make a school for these kids? School for these kids? Absolutely not. I'm not a zookeeper. Because it becomes a zoo. It's not a school. It's a halacha like this in the Gemara. It says, Talmud Sheinai Hogain, an undesirable student. A, Machzir Noisai Lamutov, you straighten him out, and then Machnis Noisai Lebeis Medrash, you send him to school. You can't send him to school unless he's qualified to be in school. Okay, these kids all day long, either they have jobs, or they're doing nothing with themselves, or they are occupying their time with sometimes harmless or maybe self-destructive things. My goal is to straighten out their personality. I can try to get them into a school if I can. I can try to get them a job if I can. Sometimes a school and a job is not the best thing for them. I'll tell you why. Because who once said, some guy, you show me a satisfied person and I'll show you a worthless one. In other words, if these kids really want to change, usually the motive is because they're unhappy with their life as it is. They went out into the streets, they thought it would be glorious and this and that, and they see it's all tzaras. You get them a job, you get them a yeshiva, you get them a school. They're happy. They don't need frumkeit anymore. They're done. It happens sometimes with therapists like that. I know a couple of kids that went to therapists. They're no longer delinquents. They're upstanding members of the community, but from Kite they're not interested and they don't need it. If you have a kid that's mamish down and out, he's bottomed out, you tell him, look, I'll help you. Straighten yourself out. Come back. The chances are more that he'll come back. So you have to, even though I know it's in the books, technically, it's according to the establishments, the right thing to do is to get a kid into a school, into this, but it's a pikuach nefesh. It's a judgment call and you're dealing with someone's life. Sometimes, let them bottom out, then they'll come back. It's a gamble. It's a gamble no matter what you do. It's a gamble. It's a very big risk. It's a judgment call with somebody's life. You're a surgeon. In this business, you're a surgeon. I mean, I've had a kid who's dead. Speeding, car accident, middle of the night, passed the red light, he was high. I have kids who are spiritually dead and emotionally dead. And I have kids who wish they were dead. We're surgeons. And you need a lot of siyata d'shmaya. But what I'm saying is, there isn't always one goal for all of the kids. You know, getting them into a school is good, but not, sometimes it's counterindicated.
Something like day treatment, where you kind of
meet
with them during the day?
Yeah, I do that. And what I do is I divide them up into groups, and I try to make small groups, and I try to make sure that certain ones don't meet other ones.
Because
like I said, the biggest influence on a kid is their friends. Anybody else?
How pervasive is the drug crime?
Not as pervasive as people think. Drugs, if they do drugs, usually they experiment with marijuana. Drug addicts, very few and far between. Drug dealers are more. There's more drug dealers because you make money dealing drugs. And I'm not talking, they don't deal big drugs. The worst thing that I've ever had a kid with, I never had any kid that was shooting up. Maybe there are, but I've never come across. They take acid sometimes, but those are the really hardcore kids. The average drug addict among our community is buying nickel bags and dime bags of pot and they're smoking it. And that you have around a lot. I know how it sounds, but yeah.
What do you do with kids that have no business? So they've done the circuit or they're
big,
really in a place where they shouldn't be.
Yeah, big problem. I've taken kids into my home. I know people that take kids into their home. People that work with me do it. There are people who volunteer to take them into their home. There are big risks over there. Not the least of which is that the parent is going to sue you for every penny you have. So far, that has never happened. But technically, theoretically, it is a possibility. We don't have any group home for kids, and OHEL only has one for boys with limited capacity. And the girls are more important to get off the street than the boys. We are trying, we're going to try to raise money to make one eventually where we can have a group home for boys and a group home for girls very far away from the group home for boys. But you're right, at this point, I don't have the money or the facilities to give a kid a permanent residence unless I put him in my basement.
What do you tell them? Do some of them hook up with each other? They
will hook up with each other. They all know each other. You know one, you know the other. It's like any other industry, right? All rabbis know each other. If you don't know this rabbi, you know someone who knows him. All psychologists know each other. You know someone that knows him. All street kids know each other. They support each other. It's their own society. It's one of our problems. They're warm and safe and cuddly in their own blanket of emotional support that they give each other. It's acceptance. I have. But that's really. It still needs a lot of money for that too. You have to find something to do with them a whole day. You need insurance. You need lots of types of things. And I don't have it. I had to throw a kid out of my house on Chol Hamoed. Started up with my 8-year-old daughter. And he was in my house. I told him he has to leave. We threw him out. Where he is now, I don't know. I promised him, nevertheless, that I would help him. I said, but you can't stay here. There's lots of problems with these kids. Anything else? Thank you very, very much. It's been a pleasure being here. I enjoyed it. And have a good day.